Welcome to Podcast Deluxe, episode 2, your I Keep My Side of the Street Clean of Weekly Cultural Review. I'm John Caramonica.
I'm Joe Coscarelli.
If you were here last week, thank you. If you're joining us this week, also thank you. Podcast Deluxe, in case you're unfamiliar, is a spinoff show of Podcast Original Recipe, which is our weekly music podcast here at the New York Times. We're here on YouTube. We're talking pop music, TikTok, popular culture, trending television, absurdist, fake avant-gardists, like all things like that, right?
Yeah, and where all those things intersect.
Yeah, and inside of us is where they all intersect. So this week, let's tell you a little bit about what we're going to get into. First, we're going to talk about the Idol.
How could we not?
We're going to talk about Taylor
Swift.
And we're going to talk about Taylor and Matty Healy. We're going to do a lot of deep breath work this week because it's tough stuff. Taylor and Matty Healy, Taylor and Ice Spice, Taylor Eras Tour, question of the week, song of the week. So let's just jump right into the Idol.
You're the American dream. Rags to riches. Trailers to mansions. You are fucking Jocelyn.
Great lighters. Beautiful lighters.
Big moment for Capri cigarettes.
Wow, true. True. And as a non, even I as a non-smoker can acknowledge that. Episode 1 appeared on the internet or on whatever these apps are on HBO.
Max.
Sure. Fine. It was incredibly a big joy for me to download the Max app. Really, really a great technological experience to have to like have a Samsung password to download the Max app. Like that was great. I enjoyed that. It was great timing for a new show rollout. So this show is about Jocelyn, who is a pop star in the mold of a Britney, maybe a Miley, there's like touchstones, maybe a little Madonna, who is either empowered or controlled. The show is either deeply lecherous or comment on lecherousness. It's campy or absolutely unfunny. It's one or the other, depending how you look at it. It pains me a little to say, I'm not sure if it's good or bad. I feel
doesn't
like
matter.
Probably doesn't matter. I want to give it a little bit of space to figure out if it's good or bad. I can say the last scene in the first episode is unequivocally bad, like absolutely terrible.
And not safe for work.
Definitely not safe for work. We will not be showing a clip of that. I can say Lucio Fontana is spinning in his grave. That is simply all I will say. The Idol has been, dare I say, bathed in controversy since before anyone has seen anything of the Idol. Can you talk a little bit about all the stuff that went wrong before whatever happened on the first episode?
So the first thing not going for the Idol is that it's created from the sick and twisted mind, is the way they put it, of Sam Levinson, who is both HBO's biggest hit showrunner of the moment, creator and writer and director of Euphoria. Mm-hmm. The hold that Euphoria had on the youth in season 2 mm-hmm. was unlike anything we've seen since.
I can't think of anything at quite that fever pitch.
And HBO's most popular show since Game of Thrones, like a total blockbuster in every way, and yet, for all of the love that people have for Euphoria and its characters, this happened throughout the second season, they came to loathe Sam Levinson, who is single-handedly responsible for everything you're seeing on screen. And yet he took on this sort of, it's like a all-powerful Oz figure.
Evil where, puppeteer.
Yeah, where he is seen as King Dirtbag. Too much nudity. Why are the characters behaving this way? Why is he writing out one character and centering another?
But similar to the themes of the Idol, which is who has autonomy here? Do the actors have autonomy? Does the showrunner, the show creator have autonomy? Who's really in charge? Like, what is being in charge of one's body? What is being in charge of one's performance? And a lot of the discourse around Euphoria, especially as conversation got bigger and bigger, was based, and this is also true with the Barbie Ferreira not leaving the show and because of the character arc, alleged, you know, we don't really know what happened, but this sense that someone is maliciously manipulating everything that is happening on screen. Now, I don't know what happened behind the scenes on Euphoria, but I can say that it is literally the job of the showrunner and show creator to maliciously manipulate everything.
He was doing his job.
Or benevolently manipulate. Right. That is literally what it is. And the actors participate, presumably, are open to the idea of being in a show like that.
So you take that growing backlash against Sam Levinson, lightning rod of the moment.
Yeah.
And you pair that with The Weeknd, who used to be that and then sort of outgrew it, got so big that he was no longer controversial.
You would think.
You would think. And then by basically returning to his sleazy, quote unquote, past in this character, Tedros, that he plays, a nightclub owner with a rat tail in The Idol. And also sort of, basically he buried this question of whether you could separate his art from his persona and his person. And then he dug it back up and is now replaying it all over again in his first
fictionalized life
television show.
Yeah, it's interesting because The Weeknd managed to somehow avoid that litigation. I remember, okay, so some caveats here. I did the first real big profile of The Weeknd at the moment, just after the mixtape era, going into the Max Martin era. This was an incredibly transformative stretch of time.
We don't talk about Kissland.
That Radio City show was strange. I just want to say, it's an odd moment. But yes, we don't really talk about that. That was an unusual time in which he got so big, so fast, off of songs that even for me, as someone who listens to music professionally, was stupefied by. I did not understand. A lot of it had to do with social media mystique. A lot of it had to do with the power of the anonymous in this era. CC, J. Paul, et cetera, et cetera. And then all of a sudden, The Weeknd had this awakening. I can go into the system, can work with Max Martin, and I can take the sort of bones of what Max Martin does and apply my sleaze, quote unquote, subject matter on top of it. And then over time, he just became a very reliable hitmaker with less and less controversial subject matter.
Right. Blinding Lights, like one of the biggest songs of all time. Not about anything gross.
No.
As far as I can tell.
And also like the soundtrack for like maybe the most benign dance trend on the internet of any like dance trend that ever boosted a song to go somewhere. Except maybe Renegade. It's interesting to see what The Weeknd has learned or not through the lens of this show. There are moments that feel really 101 to me, like pop music is a Trojan horse.
Right.
You can say, and it's like, yeah, that's true. But also The Weeknd, if he's saying that he is Trojan horsing dangerous ideas through irresistible earworms, if that's really what he's saying, it's not exactly what contemporary Weeknd music is like. It may have been what 2014 or 15, whenever that was, Weeknd music was like, but it's not necessarily what contemporary Weeknd's music is like.
So then you take The Weeknd's cultural capital, you take Sam Levinson's Euphoria cultural capital, you pair them together to make this show that is, like you said, maybe sending up pop culture.
I can't tell. Hero worship
and whatever.
But the fact that we can't tell is that's like a red flag right off rip that I don't know the answer. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, and the other issue is before the show even premieres, they hold it back from critics. Nobody sees it before it premieres. And B, there's this expose in Rolling Stone about the set and how it was a mess and how the show had become what it was satirizing, how Amy Simetz, the original director, was removed in favor of Sam Levinson because she maybe gave it too much of a female perspective.
There, the words of the story.
Yeah. And this becomes a huge controversy before anyone had seen a moment of The Idol. And
it should have been like whispered about for a long time, but no one really understood what was going on. And this was a lot of people's first engagement. And I can't actually help but wonder a tiny bit of, you know, who's having this conversation? Is this someone who wants to torpedo the show and like get it off the HBO schedule? Is it actually coming from inside the house? Is it people like trying to gin up controversy in order to get attention for it? I simply don't know.
And so then you have this sort of rush to condemn the show. It premieres at Cannes. Mm-hmm. Immediately, every review across the board is negative. I think it like, you know, on Rotten Tomatoes.
Like the lowest.
Yeah, like the lowest score ever. You know, just like, and you have the creator sort of saying, no, 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 you guys don't understand. None of this is true. And the controversy is going to help us. You know, Sam Levinson's line about it is like that he turned to his wife when the Rolling Stone thing came out and was like, we're about to have the biggest show of the summer. And then here it comes on HBO, first episode. And it's fine. It's not dangerous.
It's not as dangerous as it thinks it is.
Here's what I'll say. This is, you know, it's going to sound like I'm trolling, but I'm not.
As with literally everything.
Everything we say, right.
First of all, just for if you made it this far, and what Joe just said is true of literally everything that we say. We may sound like we're trolling, but we're not.
I had more fun watching the premiere of The Idol than I had watching this entire season of Succession.
Oh!
With maybe the exception of the election episode, which I thought was by far the best episode of the season. Succession is over. The Idol took its spot. I'm so relieved.
We'll maybe get back to the Succession thing.
I'm so relieved.
Okay. Okay. But like... Okay, so the Idol emerging at this moment actually made me think of something you said last week. You're talking about the Dare. You're talking about post-pandemic, post-Me Too.
Yep.
We're talking about a show that emphasizes physical contact, sweat, dancers in clusters, hands all over each other, a very, very greasy approach between Tedros and Jocelyn of picking up and... touching various body parts. There are all these like lingering close-ups of The Weeknd's hands, like gripping things really for... I thought a lot about what you said last week, and it does feel like a show designed to, at minimum, be a litmus test for how much sleaze and sweat there's an appetite for in the wake of 2 or 3 years of relatively hands-off, like, and obviously that's not true of everything, Euphoria, et cetera, et cetera. But it does feel like this is a test.
Yeah, and they've said as much. So Sam Levinson, Lily Rose Depp, and The Weeknd, Abel Tesfaye, did an interview, which is very rare, especially for Levinson, with our colleague Manola Dargis.
Shout out Manola.
Shout out to Manola, legend. Give her her prize, mm-hmm. etc.
Yeah, truly give her her prize.
And they said as much. They were like, this is a provocation. You know, we're saying things you're not allowed to say anymore, et cetera, et cetera. The show in its first episode, I thought was like very on the nose. But I also think everybody in a rush to say that it's bad and that it's bad for women and that Lily Rose Depp shouldn't be as naked as she is, which again is sent up in the opening scene of the show in which she's doing a photo shoot, wants to get naked, and they say the intimacy coordinator.
There's an intimacy coordinator who gets played for a fool, basically.
Right. And she's like, what? I don't even have control over my body anymore. Like, we have to do 2 days of paperwork.
Right. And of course, in the punchline, of course, being like, typically it's people encouraging the female pop star to become more provocative. Here it is, ostensibly the female pop star making that choice on her own. Although, of course, by the end of the episode, you're meant to question exactly what the meaning of agency is.
But there was something that they were saying in their interview with Manola, which I thought actually they might be giving away more of the show than they meant to, because I think they're being defensive.
Okay.
And they're basically hinting, and I think you got this in the not so subtle scene where Jocelyn and her assistant, played by Rachel Sennett, are watching Basic Instinct.
I was just, that's literally, it's right here. It's right here.
And they were like, well, we're going to find out who the bad guy is. We're going to find out who has the power, wink, wink. Like, and I think, and they also, something The Weeknd did, Abel Tesfaye, in the same interview, was to come right out and say something that was not made clear to me in the pilot, which is that Tedros is meant to be pathetic.
Oh, I actually don't agree. I think that was in there. I think the moment when he comes to the house and he's prepping and say, hello, angel, like 3 or 4 different ways, Also, the first thing I think of when I see Tedros, literally the first thing I think of, is the pickup artist.
Meet the world's most successful pickup artist. A man who goes by only one name.
Mystery.
What I thought of the first time I saw Tedros was the pickup artist. It's mystery. It's the game. It's that era of men dressing in like unexpected peacocking ways. Yep. In order to charm or dupe women. This is, of course, a terrible thing, which do not recommend and do not advocate for. But the extremity of the Tedros look, the rat tail, the particular patterns on the clothing, the rings, it all seemed to me based on a pickup artist. And that reality show, if everybody remembers that reality show, not a great moment for American pop culture, but I bet there, if Tedros had existed at that time, there would have been a photo of Tedros on the wall for those guys to be like dressed like that.
Right.
That's how it felt to me.
So you think.
So he's supposed. That to me communicates he's a little bit pathetic.
Right. Okay. So I think that this will likely become clear as the show moves on what the exact power dynamic between Jocelyn and Tedros is.
Yeah.
So just to run down really quickly what we saw in the first episode, Jocelyn is coming back from a nervous breakdown, the death of her mother. She has a comeback single ready to go.
I'm just a freak.
Just a freak.
I'm a freak or just a freak.
Which is funny because they play it so many times and it's obviously written by The Weeknd, at least in part. And like, but then dumbed down. Like there's like good hooks in it. Mm-hmm. And then they just make the lyrics as bad as possible.
You think it's produced by LePatton?
Maybe. Okay. We got to look at the credits.
Some of the music. But yeah, I wonder if it was produced by
So it's supposed to be a disposable pop song. She's insecure about it.
Yeah.
But she's gearing up to do this big comeback. She's doing a photo shoot for the cover art of whatever the album will be.
Yes.
And her team finds out that there is a explicit revenge porn is how they're spinning it. Mm-hmm. Photo of Jocelyn that hits the internet. Simultaneously, she's being interviewed for a Vanity Fair story.
Yes.
So to me, this insideriness was the most successful part of the pilot. Obviously, it speaks to us because we've seen this behind the scenes. We've been there. Troye Sivan as the creative director, right. I thought spot on.
So good.
The cameo by horror director Eli Roth coming in and playing Live Nation guy.
And what? They didn't want Eli Roth to direct the series? Hey, we're struggling to find a director. He's right there.
I think there's a fair amount of Eli Roth in the DNA of what's going on here, which I think is why his cameo made sense. Rachel Sennett, as we mentioned, playing the assistant / best friend. And in this chaos, you have Jocelyn not quite believing in her own comeback, going out for a night on the town to take her mind off of it with her stand-in.
Blackpink's Jennie. A sidebar about the role of Jennie here.
Yep.
K-pop stars are so tightly controlled contractually in their actual careers. I was really struck by how intense the Jennie moments were, how much is alluded to or suggested in the Jennie moments. These don't feel like things that an ordinary contemporary K-pop superstar would be allowed to do, which tells me that either Blackpink has a lot more freedom or latitude, or she herself has built in some stuff to her contract. But I cannot think of a time where someone who is in a top five K-pop group could be a hypersexualized choreographer / dancer / stand-in / love interest, maybe
like the sauna scene. They make
eye contact. Like that, yeah. That seemed highly unusual. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that. So I was really struck. And I actually wonder how it's going to play with the Blinks, the Blackpink fans.
I thought the rehearsal scenes outside at Jocelyn's mansion.
Dancing.
Yeah, the dancing, which is actually the Weeknd's actual mansion where they wrote and shot the show. I thought those were really effective on a filmmaking level. Mm-hmm. Like it's the choreography is purposely referencing Britney Spears.
Britney stuff, yep.
And I thought the physicality of those scenes worked and like the pop star-ness of it, like it felt big. Like was that working for you?
Yeah, absolutely. And also I liked seeing choreography that was that intense shot in a slightly askew way. She's in it and she's watching it. She's in it and she's watching it. That's sort of how I felt all embodied in how it was filmed.
So she finds out that this photo of her has leaked. This very, very, very not safe for work photo. She goes to the club to take her mind off of it.
Right.
She meets Tedros. What were they listening to in the club? Like a prayer remix.
Yes. So I thought that was interesting. I had like Basic Instinct, Like a Prayer side by side. I checked to see if they were the same year. They were not the same year. Like a Prayer, 89. Basic Instinct, 92.
Okay.
But still, an era of intense sexualization in popular culture. And both that song and that movie, watershed moments for how female sexuality was expressed in those spaces.
Right.
And obviously very, very pointed to use both those things.
Jocelyn comes home from the club.
Right.
She has a physical experience.
Yeah. It's a lot of stuff that, you know.
Yeah, this show is, you know, it's
the New York Times production.
Yeah, yeah. You can watch it if you're of age.
And have the max
out. Right. And then she later decides to invite Tedros over to her mansion.
Yes.
He shows up.
I actually really liked that scene.
Right.
Like I thought it was incredible where he like walks in and gives Rachel Sennett's character, who's the assistant, this like very intense kiss. I couldn't tell if it was on the lips or on the cheek. And she's like, thank you for that.
I mean, she's very funny.
I know.
She's also
so good. Cause like it's funny and it's deadpan, but also the entire scene is so dark and so gloomy that it's somehow it's actually more sad.
That role, I mean, the best friend / assistant, like how many of those have we met in our lives?
It's
like,
so it's on.
Really, really accurate and good. But even right before that scene, the shot of like her gate opening and he's standing there.
Oh, yeah.
He compared it in his interview with Manola to Dracula.
Yeah, I mean, so the other thing I was going to say is it's a pickup artist and then he's a vampire.
And he's definitely trying to vampire her,
of course,
her young creative juices, but she is also looking for validation, inspiration, and I think the note it leaves us on is that she is somehow going to have her third eye cracked open. Honestly, I do think people have jumped out on a limb to condemn this show without letting it unfold. Like, I just want to see where they're going. Can they land this plane?
That's sex.
This is sex.
That's sex.
Quick pivot to something else here. We're going to talk a little bit about Taylor Swift. We're going to do it in a second. It was like a very, very, very busy week or two in Taylor Swift. We're going to talk about all that stuff. But I think we should talk about other collaborations first.
Okay.
Let's do songs of the week.
All right. What do you got?
I have Sprinter.
Sprinter.
The man them too inconsiderate, 5-star hotel, smoking cigarette, mixing not with a Finnegan. She got thick, but she wanna get Finnegan. Drinking apple cider vinegar, wearing skim, cause she wanna be Kim and them. Alright, I know they are bad, stop acting innocent. We ain't got generational wealth, it's only a year that I've had these millions. My whip could have been in a Tokyo drift, cause fast and furious. I went from the Toyota Yaris to Urus, they had their chance, but blew it. Now this gal want me and her. I'm rich, let's do it.
This to me is Central C's Churchill Downs record.
Okay. Say more about that.
Okay. Churchill Downs. This is Jack Harlow and Drake. Jack Harlow wants you to know he can spit, that he can go bar for bar. He's inviting one of his heroes onto the record and saying, basically, do your best. Now, Drake does kind of like lightly outdance him on the record.
Lightly?
Okay. Drake does outdance him on the record, but you're inviting a beast into the room. It happens. I don't know exactly what Central C and Dave's relationship, but Dave's definitely an elder. He's been around a lot longer.
Sure.
I really, really like the complexity of Central C's rhyme. Central C, especially coming off of Doja. So Doja is the big Central C song that samples Let Me Blow Your Mind, the Eve record, Even What's Funny record. And I remember at the end of last year thinking like, it's like Central C's really good. This is a little bit, it's a cheap ploy.
Sure.
It's a little bit like, how do I get a pop hit? No problem. It absolutely worked. I wrote a whole thing at the end of last year about how a lot of people tried that, Jack Harlow included. It was a very busy year for people ripping off obvious pop songs.
And it's carried well over into 2023.
This feels like deliberately a pushback. I think the Central C verses are really good and complicated. I think the Dave lines are really good. Spend my money like I hate my stack. Great. Heard that girl is a gold digger. Can't be true if she dated you.
Wow.
Dark. Dark.
I mean, these are two UK rappers.
Yes. Sorry. Yes.
Which
for
I think
our
is
European viewers.
Yeah, which is crucial in this dynamic because I think Doja by Central C was very much a crossover record in that it played in the United States in a way that UK rappers don't often get.
Yeah.
Dave, an early Drake cosign.
Oh, yeah.
Many years ago.
But never has had a crack through
exact
moment.
Mm-hmm. And I think if they're sort of doubling down on this record, Sprinter, it's for their day one audience and not for their crossover audience. Do you think this song...
Oh, you think it's like a... It's
a retrenchment to me. Or do you see this song having potential legs as a Song of the Summer candidate in the United States?
No, not in the United States. But I don't even think of it as like an old British audience record. I think it's a way for Central C to build upon what has been a very successful run thus far. What's he say? Like, what's the line? Only had my millions for a year or something.
Yeah, really.
Great line.
Yeah. Evocative. Drake-like.
It's only a year that I've had these millions.
A more British syntax than you imagined.
I just need a Kleenex, man. It's literally beautiful. It's a beautiful, beautiful line. It's beautifully phrased. If I ever have millions of any kind, I aspire to say this in some context. And to me, I think what Central C is doing is suggesting to people who might be skeptical of the speed of his ascent, I'm respected by the OGs. Like I actually, and that to me is not a step back. That's actually a step forward. Mm. It's basically like, I have these catchy songs. I had this insane pop crossover song. Now, look at me. But it's not a step back. It's a step forward, building, adding legitimacy on top of success.
And that brings us back to it being his Churchill Downs, which is Harlow saying, Drake will get on a song with me, even though you think I'm this random white rapper guy.
Like, who did What's Poppin' and now like can't be taken seriously or is only doing basically like meme rap. Yeah, I think this will be really effective for building Central C in the sort of core audience. No, I don't think in America it's going to do anything, and that's okay. Like, I don't think it has to do anything here. If all he's known for is Doja, or if that's the thing he's most known for, I think that's an okay thing for now. But I think the career that he's going to have overseas on home turf, this really, really goes far in helping his case there.
The other big collaboration...
So many collaborations this week.
So many collaborations.
Really, really hectic.
On Friday, Lotto, the Atlanta rapper, put out the remix of Put It On The Floor Again with Cardi B.
Another great Cardi verse.
Another great Cardi verse.
Wow.
Cardi has not put out an album in 5+ years.
Was that when Invasion of Privacy came out?
I think so.
I was 12 years old when Invasion of Privacy came out. Is that what you're telling me?
Yes.
Oh my God.
And I was a toddler. Cardi has spent the last few summers jumping on remixes.
The hottest record of every summer?
Tomorrow 2 with Glorilla.
Shake It by K-Flock.
With K-Flock. And just delivering the most quotable, punch you in the mouth, insane verses. The video for this song, just... bafflingly good. Rip me out the plastic, I've been acting brand new. Bitches acting like they running shit, they really ran through. I spent that 500 before I ever trap you. They thought I was gonna fall off, I hate to bring you bad news. Through so many racks, a bitch can't even see the flow. From Atlanta to LA, the only time I'm back in front. Energy in the song is conveyed perfectly in the visual.
Yeah. Take notes, Sam Levinson. That's real empowerment right there.
I mean,
real empowerment.
Yeah, like this, I think this song is going to be humongous. I think instant Song of the Summer contender, though I often think that's fake, but like the construct of Song of the Summer, but Hot 97.
Oh yeah.
Not to mention every rap station in the South is going to play the hell out of this.
Got her lurking on my page before she feed her kids.
Yikes.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. What can you say? It's beautiful.
We're in a cold war of female rap collaborations.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
We can talk about this more in depth maybe another time. Yeah. But on one side is Cardi B.
Nicki Plus.
On one side is Nicki Minaj. Who they've chosen to align themselves with of the new class, who the new class has chosen to align themselves with in terms of the figureheads.
Yeah. Ice Spice did a record with Nicki. There was some suggestion that Cardi was poking at Ice Spice in the video. Yeah.
They both played Summer Jam last night.
Yep.
Cardi and Ice Spice. Mm-hmm. Some shots maybe thrown.
TBD, like we don't, you know.
Annie?
This isn't that kind of podcast.
Songs from Annie were played? It's shaping up to be, as Cameron would say, a hot summer.
Hot summer.
Ice Spice had a less controversial or more controversial remix.
Karma remix.
Karma. Taylor Swift song.
Okay, we're going to talk about the politics of it first. We're going to talk about the quality of it first.
Let's start with the song.
It's too slow.
You don't like Karma off.
I don't like original Karma.
Right.
This is better. This.
Really?
You don't think? Oh, okay. Interesting. To me, this version of Karma is a little bit better. Feels over on the whole, a little bit punchier, a little bit meaner, a little bit like feistier.
Mm-hmm.
The thing with Ice Spice and the thing that made me struggle with this verse a tiny bit. Ice Spice makes a lot of sense at a fast drill PPM, even like a pop drill, which is ultimately what Riot, her producer, really, really good at, is taking drill drum patterns and rhythms and rendering them kind of without the skittishness. And her very like punchy, like monosyllabic flow bounces really, really well on that kind of production. Karma, the first half of the Ice Spice verse moves really slow and doesn't quite feel true to Ice Spice. The second half gets a little more interesting. There's a little bit more syllabic interplay. It's a little bit more complicated, and it feels better to me. I also like that she kind of like drops out before like the four count on the last thing. I don't like love the verse, but like the second half, it was like a little bit more redeeming than the first half.
Ice Spice doing her ad libs behind Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
Love that.
Great. Like, absolutely. Yeah.
But I think this song is ultimately more meaningful, more controversial, more will be remembered as
for the lore.
Yeah, for the lore. As a news story than as a piece of music. I don't think the Karma remix.
Should we blog about it?
Look. Taylor says via Spotify that Ice Spice reached out to her to collaborate.
Wait, did Taylor say that?
Oh, yeah.
I totally missed
it. Which was very intentional messaging, because when the song was announced, and we're going to get deep into the lore now, stick with me. When the song was announced, Taylor said, I'm going to have Ice Spice on my new edition.
Pray for us.
Of Midnights.
Just pray for us.
People meaning stands online.
Everybody on the internet.
Thought that it was an apology and a chess move to bring Ice Spice into her corner because Taylor Swift's new boyfriend, Matty Healy.
Or new former boyfriend.
We'll
get to it.
Matty Healy of the 1975 rock and roll frontman of the moment.
Talk about lore.
He had gone on a comedy podcast. A comedy podcast?
Yeah, but the podcast doesn't have to be in quotes.
A podcast?
Yeah.
He had gone on a podcast, laughed along to some racially insensitive jokes about Ice Spice. Mm-hmm. There was some accent work.
Mm-hmm.
And then he apologized on stage. He didn't want Ice Spice to be mad at him. Mm-hmm. Then he started dating Taylor Swift. Fans were...
At least that's the public order of things.
Yes.
We don't obviously 100% know if that's the private order of things.
Yes.
But that is the public order of things.
Yes. Maddie Healy spent the last month showing up at Taylor Swift concerts.
Yep. Being photographed together on a couple of occasions by Paps.
Getting paparazzi to Taylor Swift, coming and going from Electric Lady, mm-hmm. studio downtown.
Yep.
This relationship, this situationship, this rebound, whatever you want to call it.
Peace to Joe Alwyn.
Tore the fandom apart. And some
it's
people...
It's hard out here for Joe Alwyn.
It's I mean, Joe Alwyn, Taylor Swift's longtime boyfriend. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who did not make it to the Eras Tour in more of the ways than one.
That's tough. That's a tough way to put it.
Where do you want to start with this? Like, was Taylor Swift...
And also, just to close the loop before we get into it, today you sent me, was it a TMZ link? That's like, Taylor Swift and Maddie Healy have broken up.
Yeah.
Which implies, number one, that they were together.
Yes.
That's like, we want to talk about like... negative verification.
Yes.
Or like counter positive verification. It says that they were together.
Yes.
I also feel like I don't totally believe it. It does feel a little bit disinformation-y to me.
The breakup.
Yeah.
Or the relationship.
All the above, but the breakup. It's basically the heat on Taylor has become so hot from the fan base. You know, there were threads on Twitter about, I want to be an ethical Swiftie. I want to honor the experiences of non-white Taylor Swift fans and her dating this person who has laughed at these jokes. People were really pushing back. And obviously, the Taylor overall brand has to be maintained. So there is something to me, lightly, potentially disinformation-y about in the immediate wake of that blowback saying, you know what? It's over. And then if they're continuing in private, they're continuing in private. I just don't know.
So in addition to the anonymous TMZ report, which like, look, like say what you will about TMZ, they're usually right.
They're usually right.
Celebrities feed statements through TMZ. Mm-hmm. They feed information through TMZ. TMZ doesn't keep inaccurate information up for very long, mm-hmm. almost all of the time. I say this as a close watcher of TMZ and a fellow journalist.
Yeah.
But right before we started filming, Entertainment Tonight also got an anonymous statement about the Taylor Swift breakup. I'll read it just for the record.
Great.
Taylor and Maddie broke up. They are both extremely busy and realize they're not really compatible with each other.
Oh, wow.
Taylor's friends want what's best for her and aren't shocked that their relationship fizzled out since she recently got out of a long-term relationship. Look, Maddie could not handle the heat of Taylor Swift. Not only Taylor Swift in general, but Taylor Swift at this exact moment. I think it's...
Do you think that?
I think
actually not sure I agree with
his that. His public persona could not handle the level of scrutiny that she is under on a daily basis, and especially that she is under in this moment. I think it is important to say something I realized this weekend as the Eras Tour rolled through the tri-state area. I missed it. I was out of town. I will go.
We're coming. We're coming to your town.
Yeah, we'll be there.
We'll be there.
We'll be there. Again. And again, maybe. Taylor Swift is bigger than she's ever been.
Oh, yeah.
Which I did not expect.
Yeah.
We thought we were... Obviously, Taylor's going to be around for our whole lives. She'll be making music. I thought she had peaked commercially. I thought she had peaked
like
as a pop star.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Taylor is so big and so important right now. I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting that it's happening to Beyonce sort of simultaneously, like a new peak in terms of the hold that she has on the culture.
Yeah, yeah.
But like everything that Taylor does is under a microscope. Mm-hmm. It's very wild that she picked Maddie Healy as her first new boyfriend in nearly a decade. What's your read on Maddie as a public figure, a musician, and a Taylor Swift foil and or ally?
I'll answer those in different order than you asked them. As a musician, I think the 1975 is a very smart band, but maybe not always a great band. I think the albums are real up and down.
Sort of by design.
Yeah, and stylistically and quality-wise.
Yep.
I like that there's an erraticness to the 1975 that I think is extremely unusual in contemporary stardom. I think a lot of the, forget bands, like any musician, you know, will joke about eras, whether it's Taylor or anybody else, but like very rarely are they doing something so totally different from what they were doing previously. You know, even Beyonce, Drake, it's like, it's all kind of within the same family of stuff. I do think that the 1975, generally speaking, is willing to kind of like break the old stuff and just be like, oh, we tried this thing. It's kind of new wavy. Oh, we tried this thing. It's a little bit more punkish or emo-ish, whatever. I like that. I don't love all the records, but I like
the project.
I like the idea that it exists.
And it's mostly an idea.
It does feel like an idea. And that leads me to the next thing. To go back to something we said earlier, you know, we seem like we're trolling, but we're not. This is the interesting thing about Matty Healy and about the 1975, but certainly Matty Healy, the public persona, right? Matty Healy, to me, seems like a person who does not want to break things, but finds himself constantly breaking things, and then ultimately saying, it's not so bad that I've broken this thing. That's how he seems to me. I don't know if that's really the sort of intent, you know, not to get all Foucault with it. Like, I don't know, like, the intention of the artist here. Like, but it does seem there's something, like, lightly bumbling about the breaking of things. And that kind of instability, like, if you're saying it's an odd choice for Taylor, maybe it's an odd choice because compared to Joe Allen, maybe after you dated Joe Allen for 100 years, you need someone like a Matty Healy.
This is a classic situation.
Yeah, I can't speculate.
The dynamic is classic.
We're not a dating podcast. Despite advertising, we're not a dating podcast. But I do think that there is fundamentally a sincerity at the core of Matty Healy. This comes out, I think, in the Gia story.
New York profile. Amazing luck of timing.
Great. Perfect. Yeah.
Amazing luck of timing.
Good. Absolutely dead on. I do think there's a fundamental sincerity at play, but much like you or I, or maybe other people we talk about from time to time, the people who are sitting in judgment of Matty Healy are often less culturally or socially sophisticated or aware than he is. And I'm not saying that that means that everything he's doing is some advanced placement thing and no one's seeing it that way. But I am saying that it's much more playful than I think a cold read allows for. And that has been incredibly frustrating to see Matty Healy, who I think is sometimes right, sometimes wrong, often playful, but fundamentally sincere, being read completely flat in like the worst possible way by people who maybe 5 years from now might get the joke a little bit more.
This is what I meant by he couldn't stand the heat. Like, his persona couldn't stand the heat of this Taylor Swift moment in particular. Look, I've spent a fair amount of time with Matty Healy professionally over many years. Mm-hmm. I've talked to him for hours and hours on end. He's a real talker. Mm-hmm. I will say this, even if it's controversial, I've often described Matty Healy as the person, the musician that I've met through my job who is the most like you. Me and the people I hang out
yeah,
with.
Yeah, sure.
Matty Healy, a voracious consumer of music, of books, of culture, a huge fan of Dime Square, for lack of a better term.
Sure.
Which is what got him into trouble.
I literally can't believe we've done two episodes and it's like Indie Sleaze and Dime Square have come out of our mouths.
I mean, but look, Matty Healy he's in the way that he's...
And also just
he's a British person.
You know, I've seen you at Clandestino.
He's a British person. Matty has been to Clandestino.
But I'm just saying, like, we're not above it.
We're not above it.
We're not above it. But like, you know, we have a little bit of like...
He is a British person obsessed with America. Obsessed with American culture.
Yeah.
He's on the record in between having maybe dated Taylor Swift 10 years ago, very briefly.
Oh, right. There was a...
And this time now, he's on the record saying, like, oh, she's an icon, you know, I would never slag her off or whatever he said. You know, like he's been in the Taylor Swift conversation business for, like I said, nearly a decade now. He thinks about all these things in a meta way. He has a song called Sincerity is Scary. Complicated stuff. And you're right that it's being read on the Stan level as something way less complicated than it is.
Right. And if you are perpetually operating in the realm of meta-narrative, if you are perpetually operating in that realm and you are suddenly exposed to an absolute universe of people who do not function on any level other than narrative, that's got to be, number one, completely disorienting because you're not being received the way you're intended. And look, I don't just, did Taylor, assuming they broke up, did Taylor cut him off? Did he cut bait and say, I can't do it? Like, the damage is too profound. Like my career to the extent that this is affecting my career, it's like potentially irreparable damage. Like, which of those is more likely, do you think?
I mean, as we know in popular culture, like most controversies are net gain, net positive.
Yes.
1975.
As they say on the Idol.
Yeah. 1975 has a really...
Also, shout out Dan Levy, who I thought did a great job.
So, oh, sorry. Yeah. He's good.
Dan Levy.
Solid. As the publicist?
Yeah. I guess he's the publicist or like a publicist. Yeah.
Yeah.
Solid. Great.
1975 sells out arenas around the world. Like has... many albums, has been a band for their whole lives, basically, their childhood friends. Mm-hmm. They're not hurting for attention, but they just exist in a pretty narrow slice of the world. Now
it's context collapse.
It's
like classic context collapse, which is a thing that happens on Twitter constantly. It's classic context collapse, but just happening on like a global scale.
Which isn't to excuse the racist or sexist or sus stuff that he said, because he does say that stuff and then he apologizes for it or he doubles down on it. Like, but he is at least
like, it's like watching Oasis, like the Gallagher brothers, like absolutely going.
And he's into it with them too.
No, I know. But it's like, it's what's funny is like, if you only ever understood how a person in a band is supposed to be from growing up in England, this would seem completely normal.
Right.
But coming up through the lens of American pop star fandom, it feels absolutely foreign, absolutely unhinged.
But I think that he's going to get through it because this is what he does. This is at a higher level than has ever happened. But I don't think...
it's folded into the thing.
Yeah, but I don't think love, even love, can withstand the Swiftie army in 2023. I think they just never had a chance. We're going to get some music out of this. From both sides.
Oh, yeah.
Like, no doubt. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe really soon. I mean, like, they're going to want to strike while all of this is still in the world.
Please let us know which Eras Tour stop the new song is going to get debuted. I'd like to have a little bit of a heads up on that.
I just, like, do you think this hurts Taylor? Are we bracing for another round of, now we put Taylor back on this throne and it's going to be time to, like, pull at it again to drag her under? Like, this is the game we've been playing with her for however many years now, 15 years.
I will say this felt, during the real heat of it, like a week ago or whatever, this felt like the biggest existential threat to the Taylor moment or to Taylor's ascendance and reign at the top that I've felt in a long time. And I've even her speaking out like on behalf of LGBTQ rights a couple of nights ago, it all felt like I'm trying to like claw it back. Like I'm trying to like, if you think that I've gone too far, and this has come up a lot with Taylor over the years, like how progressive is she really? How supportive is she really? Like how much of an ally across all forms of allyship is she really? And this is something that I think certain parts of the Swiftie army have had some concerns or confusion about. And this felt to me the loudest and the most potentially damaging to her. So I was not totally surprised to see that this relationship ended. I was not surprised to see that. And I think the Taylor brand, like you said, love can't withstand that, even love.
And we also, I will say, even before the breakup, had the backlash to the backlash, which was people asking, why does Taylor have to be responsible for the behaviors of grown men?
Right.
So that's out there too. I think, you know, the Eras Tour is going to go on a couple more months.
At least.
She's going to travel the world. She's going to put out more and more music. Speak Now, Taylor's version is coming with all the Vault songs. Dear John is on there. Speaking of...
Talk about top five Taylor songs of all time.
And problematic boyfriends. I just think...
Been here before.
We've been here before and we'll be here again.
Yeah.
But I don't think Maddie knew what was coming for him.
It's funny, like, I know that's a natural ending point, but I do want to say, I do think he... I don't think he knew what was coming for him, but I think he knew what fire he was playing with. I do think he knew that. I don't think... This is not like an unfamous... This is not an unfamous person.
No, he's
person.
A professional fire juggler.
Literally, it's the work. Now, was this fire 50 degrees hotter than maybe he anticipated? Possibly. But I don't think he went in there thinking it wasn't fire. I don't think he went in there thinking, I can't make something of this. I'm not saying it was purely cynical, but I think on some level, that's the art. The art is the music. The art is the songwriting. And the art is the living. And with Maddie Healy, frankly, more than most.
Should we take a question?
Boy, should we. Let's take a question. Every week we're going to take a question. This one's from the Discord. Shout out to the Discord. I should say, get in the Discord and get in the Facebook group. It's tinyurl.com/popcastdiscord or /popcastfacebook. Big conversations going on in both. We've got in the Discord various channels. There's mailbag channel. And this comes from the mailbag channel.
And if you're not on Discord, you could leave us a question in the YouTube comments.
Absolutely leave in the YouTube comments or email us, popcast@nytimes.com. We are
reachable.
Fully networked. Okay, here's something from the Discord. This is from Ace of Cups. It seems like we've had an uptick in the number of pop star documentaries. Everybody from Demi Lovato, Taylor Swift, Selena Gomez, Charlie XCX has come out with their own film in just the last 5 years. And some are even submitting them to festivals for awards. That's rich.
What awards are these movies winning?
It's just very rich. Like it's I don't know if it's true, but if it's true, LOL.
Video Music Awards.
Yeah, People's Choice documentary about a pop star that was approved by the Pop Star Award. Yeah, that's everybody's a winner. Why do you guys think so many celebs are embracing this medium to tell their stories now? What do you guys enjoy about these documentaries and who would you like to see make one?
Well, MGK already made one. Do you know what the arc of the MGK documentary is?
I know what the arc of the MGK fictional film that stars Lil Huddy.
Didn't see that one. I think the documentary, which is called Life in Pink, is about can he get his second number one album? Like that's the tension. Yeah, yeah.
So the documentary takes place in a record label office where a bunch of mid-level executives try to determine what other albums are coming out on various weeks to make sure that this album comes out on a week that basically like Bad Bunny's not coming out.
Yeah.
That's exactly what the documentary is about.
Yeah.
I'd like to see that.
And Megan Fox.
And also Megan Fox.
Right.
MGK, there's that great tweet. He did that freestyle a couple weeks ago where he's like going at Eminem and like someone tweeted, I can't remember. I'm sorry.
No, he's not mad at Eminem this time. It's
Jack Harlow. Oh, yeah. Jack Harlow. Sorry. Right. Sorry.
Say again.
So he's like, no. Just it's fine. He's mad at Jack Harlow. And then someone tweeted like MGK turned into Rakim when it's time to diss a white rapper. Incredible. Best music criticism in the last couple months. Great.
Pop star documentaries. The best part of them is the access. We're going to say something nice. The best part of them is the access.
We also did an episode of Original Popcast a couple years ago on this exact question. Yes. Not much has changed since then, but we do talk about a bunch of these films.
Taylor Swift, Billie Eilish.
Blackpink, which is my favorite.
Blackpink,
that's the one that I like the best, which is called Light Up the Sky.
Right. The answer is that there's a boom in... the need. Money. Yeah, there's a boom in the need for streaming content. There was. Maybe it's cooling.
Yeah.
Famous people reliably clicked on in every format. Really good for the good streaming services.
Good thumbnails on a streaming service.
Good thumbnails.
Really good thumbnails.
We love a good thumbnail.
We love a good thumbnail.
look, these are not journalism.
Although they pretend to be. The Billie Eilish one pretends to be. And then at the end, it's like executive producer, Interscope Records. Right. It's like, I too would like to see true behind the scenes stuff. You know, if you go back to the Metallica documentary about
some kind of monster.
Yeah. Like
one of the best music documentaries ever.
Yeah. Them being in group therapy about everybody's ego problems. Like that's incredible. I don't think anyone young is making anything on that level. I mean, what do I think about this? I think these are marketing opportunities. I think these are people who are presented with $1 to $2 to $3 to $5 to $9 million and said, please deliver us a film. And then they go and get a reputable filmmaker to make a film. Is it quasi journalistic? Sure. It's quasi documentary. Sure.
Are there revealing moments?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But are there revealing moments on Instagram Lives?
Right.
Yeah. There's revealing moments on Instagram Lives and on TikToks and all these other places. I feel like a lot of, God, I'm about to sound crazy old right now, but I think a lot of words have lost their meaning over the years.
This is a favorite of our editor, Karen Gantz. Words have meaning.
And Karen is right. The word documentary.
Yeah.
Again, look, I'm open to the idea that words have meaning, but those meanings might evolve. But I do think that that word has a specific meaning and has a specific context. Like, you know, if people want to say vinyls instead of vinyl now, that's cool. I'm not tripping.
Is it?
That's fine. I'm okay. Not tripping off it at all.
Open-minded.
Yeah. It's often said.
Yeah.
Often said. But as documentary, the idea that the subject maintains editorial control or approval of the documentary, that's a no-go. And so these things that we're calling music documentaries, quote unquote, are they documentaries? Are they music narrative? Are they nonfiction narrative? Or are they just long commercials? It's possible to have a commercial in a documentary form.
Yes. I don't want to get into the question about whether documentaries are journalism. Like, shout out to Errol Morris. Like, we could, like, even, you know, like, there's a long conversation.
I love your Botox commercials.
There's a long conversation to be had here. Maybe Leslie, our director, will come in and have this conversation with us one day, a documentarian herself. But I just want to pull back the curtain.
I love the Botox. I think they're
really good.
They're so weird.
But I just want to pull back the curtain for a second, say that the reason these documentaries are happening is because everyone always wants to make and watch music documentaries. Yeah. The hardest part is getting the music licensed.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
It often will halt a project because the label and or
controls,
the estate
or the publishing.
Yeah. If you can't use the songs,
what are we doing
here? The easiest way to get the songs in the documentary is to make the documentary with the label itself, with the artist themselves. Do you lose something in the process? Of course. Kids, adults, whoever, go watch Some Kind of Monster, the Metallica documentary. Go watch Truth or Dare, the Madonna tour documentary.
An unbelievable movie.
Go watch The Carter, the Lil Wayne documentary.
If you can find it.
So hard to find. That's how good it is.
Largely scrubbed from the internet.
That's how good it is.
Yeah. I feel like it's time for a snack.
I need a snack.
It's late. It's been a weird couple of weeks. I'm feeling a little unsettled. Last week, snack number one came from Karen. It's not available to the public, at least not yet. Karen's banana bread. But I had brought a snack last week, not knowing that the Karen banana bread was arriving.
And we're going to do this every week, to be clear, on Popcast Deluxe. John and snack I, big junk food heads, love a new flavor, love a controversial combination.
Absolutely. Unexpected. Love exotics in the parlance of New York smoke shops that are selling things they're not supposed to be selling and are covering them up by selling Japanese flavored Pringles, you know, Japanese exclusive Pringles. So I brought something last week that sort of happened to be kind of like in the mode of what Karen ended up giving us. So I brought it back this week because I think let's have a little continuity. Got these at 7-Eleven somewhere upstate, maybe like a month ago, month and a half ago. D's, D-E-E apostrophe S. I don't know who D is. But these are...
I'm scared of these, to be clear.
They're banana flavored. Okay. Naturally and artificially flavored. Yeah.
Clearly. We know.
Yeah. Trust me.
Thank you.
Clearly. Nanner pudding seasoned. Vanilla and banana pudding gourmet seasoned peanuts.
My main concern about these...
Also, like, I've never seen these before I found them at 7-Eleven. Never seen them subsequent. I do not know what the distribution mechanism of this product is.
This is not sponsored, by the way.
Not even slightly
sponsored. This is anti-sponsored. We're going to say what we mean. My main concern about these is that they could have been on the shelf at 7-Eleven for 2 decades.
Okay. I mean, first of all, they smell the artificial smell.
Oh, okay. It smells like peanuts.
And
not nanners. Okay. Let me just say, the first flavor has nothing to do with the second flavor.
That's totally accurate. Also, here's what's crazy. The first flavor is what's on the inside.
Yeah.
And the second flavor is what's on the outside. How's that possible?
I got it in reverse.
Okay. I got it. I got the peanut first, and then I got the nana.
No, I got hit over the head with a banana runt. And then then I just ate a normal peanut. Oh yeah. These are not good.
Yeah. Were we doing ratings?
Or just... Yeah. I mean, this is a 2 out of 10.
5 or 6.
Are you gonna eat the rest of this?
No, but it's like, it's not long car ride.
No.
Pop in at 7-Eleven.
No.
Get this. Mm-mm. Over the course of an hour or two. Big thief on the radio.
That's what goes with Nanner.
Just going right in. I guess simply what I would say is these exist.
Barely.
They do. That's our show. Leslie Davis is our director. Thanks to Karen Gans, Pedro Rosado, the studio managers, the video team, Nell Galogli, everybody who makes this run seamlessly and despite appearances does run seamlessly. So we appreciate everybody's help. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. And also watch all these episodes on youtube.com. Type in Podcast Deluxe. We are on the New York Times channel. That's
where at NYTimes, youtube.com/@NYTimes. Get the merch.
Get the merch. T-shirts and stickers. It's the podcast.myshopify.com. And subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio, Spotify, Apple, and right here on YouTube. We'll be back next week.